May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brian Cruz. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Hands, Inc., doing business as H&S Plumbing and Heating. We are here because we assert that the district court erred in applying promissory estoppel where a general contractor did not rely or reasonably rely upon a quotation from H&S Plumbing. Our brief touches on a number of legal issues. However, unless the court is inclined to take me a different way, I intend to talk about three of them. One is the contract documents at issue, which absolutely preclude the application of promissory estoppel. Bid shopping, that was the evidence, was occurred by the general contractor and the existing Nebraska president of Hawkins Construction. And what that case says about anticipated future negotiations of contracts and whether or not promissory estoppel is applied, we assert that not only is this case similar to Hawkins, it's probably the defense of promissory estoppel is actually stronger in this case than it was in Hawkins. Before I get into those three issues, though, I would like to bring to the court's attention something I'm sure it knows, which is the standard of review in this case is de novo on the record. The court will come to independent conclusions of facts and law. We really have a fresh look in this case. There is the holding of the court that says that if there is evidence in conflict, that deference will be given to the trial court. I put it to this court that there really isn't a lot of evidence that's in conflict on the issues that we've raised. The issues all focus on White's company and its employees and their actions and what they did, their testimony, and the documents in the case. Also focuses on a third-party witness who was testified by deposition and video deposition. So really,
I
think
are you saying that promissory estoppel and breach of contract are separate and distinct remedies and that you have to elect one or the other remedies in order to proceed?
We asserted that in our brief,
but
I think, certainly breach of contract is a legal doctrine. Promissory estoppel is an equitable doctrine. I have asserted to district courts in this state that juries should not be trying promissory estoppel cases because
contract,
the remedies are different.
Does the contract establish part of the basis for asserting promissory estoppel?
Well, the promissory estoppel case rests on the assumption that there is no contract. And if there is no contract, you have a litigant coming into court asserting...
Did you claim there was no contract?
That's the basis. That's the legal basis of promissory estoppel, that there is no contract. And I believe, yes, the...
You can't have it both ways either, can you? You can't argue that it's breach of contract and therefore promissory estoppel doesn't apply.
I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing that it's neither. In terms of the relief, both issues were presented to the judge at the same time, and at the trial court they said, no, there's no contract.
And that hasn't been appealed.
That's not been appealed by either side. Okay. However, the court said, we're going to rely on promissory estoppel. The issue on election of remedies is, can you present both at the same time when the evidence required to sustain a promissory estoppel claim is there's no contract, and the evidence required to sustain a breach of contract case is there is a contract.
Let me ask you this. Did your client withdraw his bid because of different terms in the subcontractor's agreement with White's?
That was not the express reason that it was withdrawn.
You withdrew it before there was a contract from White's to you.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
The evidence at issue, though, and we're bringing up the Hawkins case, which is that is what happened in the Hawkins case. The contract was presented; they rejected the terms. However, I think if you look at the particular facts of this case, what we have is the fact that the contract that was to be submitted, Alan Kennedy and Brian Mount. Alan Kennedy testified at White's.
Now, what's the contract? Which one?
The actual formal contract that
from
was
the
used
the owner
from the
Good Samaritan
from White's. White's proposed contract.
Okay,
with your client,
not with my client. Okay. That it uses in general. It gives its employees no discretion to vary those terms. And I think if you look at the testimony of Mr. Kennedy on this issue, what he says is we always use this contract. So this contract would have been given to H&S Plumbing. You would start by handing
but
them your
you
form
reject,
contract.
You withdrew your bid before you even obtained that agreement.
That's true.
Agreement.
Absolutely cannot deny that. However, I think when you look at whether or not reliance was reasonable, and whether or not we apply the Hawkins case, the question is not, did you have a chance to look at the contract? The question is there are there anticipated future negotiations that are going to take place? And certainly, given that that was the form contract that Alan Kennedy testified was always used, that had to go up the chain of command, if any terms were different, then there were contractual differences. And that form contract that they always had to use was materially different than the bid, the quotation that was submitted by H&S Plumbing.
Was there evidence on the record that the subcontractor's contract was never changed, or it was just entered into without changes over years? Or do I have that wrong?
There was no evidence. Well, the subcontractor's proposal, there was some testimony, I believe, that these parties had worked together several years before, and they'd worked their differences out in the past.
Well, you say there's no reliance. Weitz was actually the general contractor, right?
Correct.
And it had to hire its subcontractors. And in order to do that, you claim it bid shopped around, but then when it finally got all the bids together, then it was able to submit to Good Samaritan a bid on the total completion of the project.
Not quite. The bid shopping would take place after the total bid was submitted, because the bid shopping requires that the bids be submitted. Some had not been firmed up. Some had presented quotations.
But based upon what H&S Plumbing told Weitz, Weitz factored that into the total bid price that it was going to submit to Good Samaritan, and then submitted that bid based upon that subcontractor's bid from H&S Plumbing, or the amount.
That would go to whether or not probably there was a promise, but it wouldn't go to whether or not...
Well, I think it's going to reliance, because it doesn't that determine the amount of the bid based upon what you think you can sub your contract out for?
Not according to John Sampson. What John Sampson would say, who was presented what appears to be expert testimony in my mind, that in the state of Nebraska, when you have bid discrepancies and you see that there are bid discrepancies, which he saw, you can't just take a number and just throw it onto a spreadsheet and say we relied upon it. You have to use your judgment.
So you're talking about leaving money on the table in this case between the second lowest bid and H&S's bid, which was the lowest bid for the plumbing and heating.
Not so much leaving money, but what you have to do is you have to look at all of the bids.
Well, that's where you determine the discrepancy. If somebody comes in with $1 million bid and everybody else is bidding 2.5, that's evidence that something's askew here.
Absolutely.
But when your client withdrew the bid, did Weitz have a contract with Good Samaritan?
Weitz did not have a written contract with Good Samaritan. What Weitz had was it was required to leave its bid open for a period of 30 to 60 days. I'm not sure how long. But no contract had been signed. There was a contract later signed that was predated, but there was no formal contract yet. There was an open bid that Weitz had made that was supposed to be kept open, which, unlike the case here, Weitz did not require H&S to keep its bid open, which it could have done to protect itself.
So if Weitz didn't have a contract with Good Samaritan, then could they reasonably rely on the bid?
That's another issue that would say no, they could not reasonably rely upon the bid. And in fact, the contract documents from under which they submitted the bid said you cannot rely on these bids because Good Samaritan has the
right to protect. But Weitz says that their reputation was at stake and they were doing this to get in the good graces of Good Samaritan to be able to be negotiated contracts. Is that sufficient reliance?
I don't know that it's sufficient to say that that's why we rely, because of the consequences that we might take. That goes to whether or not they should repudiate their bid to Good Samaritan. But that wouldn't go as to whether or not we're sitting in the bid room that we should rely upon a quotation from H&S Plumbing.
What was the next lowest bid other than your bid? Do you know?
I have tried to figure that out, and okay. I think I can't really quite tell from the testimony exactly what it was, although the evidence is it was 15% difference.
Sounds like it was about $320,000, wasn't it?
I think the issues become when you have, when you deal with it, are the bids apples to apples, and what additions and what is different with them?
You argue that there was, the court applied the wrong measure of damages, is that correct?
We have argued that the court applied the wrong measure of damages, much to the issue of can you proceed with the breach of contract and promissory estoppel, because promissory estoppel has a different level of damages. The measure is reasonable reliance, how did you, what was your detriment, not what was the benefit of your bargain. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, and you are Ms.?
Kristen Krieger.
Ms. Krieger, good morning to you. And you may proceed.
May it please the court, Kristen Krieger on behalf of the Weitz Company, LLC. My co-counsel, Patrice Ott, is also here today. Your Honors, the district court got this case right. After listening to the witnesses, considering all of the evidence, it found that H&S is liable under the theory of promissory estoppel. And when you look at the elements of promissory estoppel, they're all here. First element, is there a promise? It appears to be undisputed at this point on appeal that H&S's bid proposal on bid day, August 30th, 2011, is a promise. There are admissions in the record to that effect. It doesn't seem to be one of the arguments that we're focusing on appeal. If you look at the second element, which is reliance, the question is, did Weitz rely on H&S's bid proposal?
Okay, Weitz didn't have a signed contract at the time that H&S took back their bid. Is that correct?
So the way the sequence goes is, we know August 30th is bid day.
Yeah.
That's the date. Weitz submits its bid to the owner. $9.2 million is the base bid amount. And on that, it's irrevocable for 60 days. So they're stuck with that $9.2 million number. They find out on September 2nd, they've been awarded the contract.
What does it mean it's irrevocable for 60 days? What does that do for the parties?
It means that for the Weitz Company, they're locked in.
For 60 days?
For 60 days.
What happens, how do they ever get out of it?
In terms of if the Weitz Company wanted to renege and say, then I think if they wanted to renege, then they would have the same issue that H&S Plumbing has in this case, which is that they've got a promissory estoppel.
I guess what I'm getting at is, there was no contract between Weitz and Good Samaritan, and there was no bid security. I mean, you weren't going to have to walk away with something and pay Good Samaritan. So your reliance is just really on Weitz's reputation, isn't it? And the fact that they wanted to get into the good graces of Good Samaritan so they could do all of Good Samaritan's work. Is that sufficient reliance?
It is sufficient reliance, and what we'll say on that is...
Is there any case law on...
What there is case law on in this area of promissory estoppel between general contractors and subcontractors is the cases have been uniform, and it starts with Drennan from California in 1958. In a case like this, if there's a mistake that's made, then the mistake is to be borne by the party who caused it. It's not Weitz's problem. That H&S claims that it made a mistake, which to this day it's still been able to
Wasn't there evidence that Weitz submitted this bid on the basis of what its plumbing and heating costs were going to be from the subcontractor and factored that into the bid that it gave to Good Samaritan?
Yes.
I mean, that's the number they used to formulate their bid.
The only way Weitz is able to come up with this bid is by relying on H&S Plumbing. That's undisputed. When you look at the bid day spreadsheet, it's a tally. It's got 50 scopes of work. This is how we reach our bid amount.
And when we say there wasn't a contract, you're saying there wasn't a signed agreement between the parties that had everything in writing.
Correct.
But there was a promise by H&S to perform the heating and air conditioning and plumbing or whatever else it was for this amount, less a couple special projects that would amount to about $90,000.
Right. And so what Weitz has to do in this case, because H&S refuses to honor its bid, is it's out of pocket $292,400.
So wasn't there evidence that Weitz always bid shopped and that they never relied on the subcontractor bids?
No, there's not evidence of bid shopping. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because in this case, H&S's strategy seems to be, well, we'll just call everything bid shopping. you know, we've got this bid, we don't want to honor it, let's find some stuff we don't like in the record, and we'll call it bid shopping. But they don't actually really examine what bid shopping is, and whether any of the stuff they call bid shopping is evidence of bid shopping.
So if you were bid shopping, you would say, I got H&S for $2.4 million, I'm going to Geico Plumbing and Heating, and they'll do it for $2 million. I'm going to use Geico Plumbing, provided Good Samaritan and the architect agree that I can use that sub.
Exactly. In order for there to have been bid shopping in this case, what you have to look at, there has to be evidence of Whites going out during this gap period. So during the time they know that they've got the contract from Good Samaritan, they've won the project, they're going to enter into this formal written contract with Good Samaritan, but they're stuck at their $9.2 million for 60 days. If they go out during that time period, before they go to H&S and say, oh, by the way, you know, we're going to go with you guys, if they're going out during that time period and saying, hey, you know, H&S bid 2.4, if you can lower your bid a little bit more and come in underneath them, we'll give you the project instead of H&S. There's no evidence of that in this case whatsoever.
Well, if they did that, what's wrong with it?
I think what the courts have found as far as bid shopping is, and you know, H&S is asking for there to be a bright line rule, but what the courts look at in terms of bid shopping is there reasonable, foreseeable reliance on the subcontractor's numbers? And courts have found, well,
that would be a cause of action for H&S against the Whites then for
right.
but, a but breach of contract.
Is, yeah.
Or they'd argue promissory estoppel.
Right. I'd like to take you back to the lack of a contract between Whites and Good Samaritan. If Whites had just walked away, what would the consequences have been?
Under the contract, so if Whites had completely walked away and said, we're not going to do this,
yeah. right?
We're not going to do this project, we bid on it, we're not interested. According to the contract documents, there was no bid security,
so
they don't forfeit that.
So you couldn't, they wouldn't be out any money, would they?
Not out, they certainly would be off. Whatever expenses it was
yes.
to prepare this bid,
yes.
but they aren't out any terms of forfeited bid security, so whether that was X number of dollars.
But their reputation's at stake.
Their reputation is totally at stake. What H&S is asking this court to do is find something no other court has found, which is that when a subcontractor makes a mistake, allegedly, and refuses to honor its bid, that loss falls on the general contractor, that it doesn't fall on the subcontractor itself. And what H&S has failed to do is present any plausible reason why, if they're the one making the mistake, why are they the ones who bear the risk of loss? And what courts have found is that, no, in this situation, this is the subcontractor's problem. It's what? Not up to the general to risk its business reputation and whatever other legal action may or may not have occurred with Good Samaritan. We're speculating that Good Samaritan doesn't have a claim.
So business representation is enough for reasonable reliance. That's your point.
What was that?
Business reputation is sufficient to furnish reasonable reliance on the bid of H&S.
In a situation like this where it's irrevocable, it is sufficient, because this isn't a case where Whites could have gone to the owner and said, you know, H&S is telling us they've got $240,000 more dollars, and so we need to up our base bid amount by that. That wasn't an option for Whites. It was irrevocable for 60 days when they submit that. So they don't.
What sort of bid security, if for want of a better term, did Whites negotiate with H&S? H&S says here today that Whites didn't require H&S to keep its bid open and that it could have. What sort of security, bid security, did you bargain for?
In terms of that, what courts have said is that as a general contractor, you don't need to. What courts have found as a matter of law, starting with Drennan, is that when you as a subcontractor submit a bid to the general contractor, it's irrevocable until acceptance.
Well, as a matter of custom, is there bid security between contractors and subcontractors?
I don't think. There's no evidence to that effect. And what the point was, if you look at H&S's bid, is that if they didn't want Whites to rely on it, or they wanted it to be revocable within 24 hours, or for whatever reason, they could have said that. Bid proposal certainly could have said, please don't rely on this, this is subject to change, we get to revoke it in 48 hours if we think there's been a mistake.
But what was your theory of damages, and how did you prove it?
So the theory of damages is promissory estoppel is relying on damages. What White's did is it went and it looked at all the other case law from all the jurisdictions and said, how are damages measured in cases like this? And what courts have said is you look at the amount of the defendant subcontractor's bid, and then you you figure that into what it cost you, what you paid your replacement subcontractors. So what was the actual cost here? And then so here what we did is we looked at what did we pay the people who actually went out and did the HVAC and did the plumbing eventually on the project. We minused H&S's bid from that amount. We took in a couple exceptions because there were certain issues regarding
there were a couple exceptions out of H&S's bid that amounted to about $90,000.
Exactly. And so we gave, you know, gave them those deductions, and it comes up with $292,400 is how the math works on that. And that measure of damages, which is what courts have done in other cases like this, is consistent with Nebraska law, because Nebraska law says in a promissory estoppel case, you know, you have somebody who's relied on a promise, and you reimburse them based on that reliance. Here, we relied on H&S to honor its bid. It refused to do so, and as a result, we're out of pocket. The testimony says we're out of pocket the $292,000 because now we have to pay those replacement subcontractors.
And the contractor's not required to walk away from the job simply because a sub reneges on the project, and the contractor has to either walk away or find alternate plumbing and heating that might cost them more.
Right. We don't think that the law requires Whites to have to walk away in this circumstance. The law requires H&S to honor its promise and refuse to do so. Out of time. If there are no further questions, we ask that the district court be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned, and you are excused.